Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
I look out at you guys and I wonder where we can start, and I'm posing this to you, kind of tossing it out. Can we get our heads around the notion that literally people like us meaning the person sitting in your seat and the one next to you, can transform and build an entirely new economy? Now, most people actually don't step up to that question, and they don't self-conceive as a transformative person who actually takes responsibility personally for changing the entire system. Because that's what this is about, by the way. Did you know that?
That's Gar Alperovitz speaking to a national gathering of the Public Banking Institute about an essential ingredient of the new efforts underway that are intended to bring about the transformation of our economic situation. Hi, I'm Walt McCree, and on today's It's Our Money, Ellen and Gar will discuss his new Next System project, a collaboration of multiple parties that are creating a new synergy for economic change. Later on, we talk with Scott Baker, who's got a new book out that outlines several ways that we can eliminate the national debt. And we'll have a little musical relief from a reformist version of The Wizard of Oz. And Matt Stannard is back to deliver this week's public banking report. But now, here's Ellen.
Thanks, Walt. Last week, I participated in a debate at San Diego State University called The Crisis of American Democracy, Beyond the Two-Party System. I'll be talking shortly to Dr. Gar Alperovitz, who has some creative solutions to that crisis. So I thought I would lay the groundwork by reviewing last week's debate. It was framed like this: with increasing levels of social inequality, racial tensions, police brutality, government surveillance, and never-ending wars, the United States today is a country in crisis. To what extent is this crisis a reflection of the state of American democracy? How democratic can the United States even be considered, given the dominance of the two-party system and the seeming contempt of both the Republican and Democratic parties for the plight of the ordinary people? So here's what I argued in my opening statement. George Carlin had it right. Politicians are put there to make us think we have freedom of choice. We don't. They own us. In fact, what we have is the choice of two parties, both of which are necessarily funded by big money. It's necessary because we live in a country of 240 million people, and in order to win a majority, you have to get on TV and other major media, which are incredibly expensive. Also, the national debates are funded by the Democrats and the Republicans, and therefore they're essentially private. Other parties are not allowed to participate. When Jill Stein, who ran for president on the Green Party ticket, and Laura Wells, who ran for California governor on the Green Party ticket, attempted to participate in the televised debates, they were both arrested. Laura said the charge was perfect. They said she was trespassing at a private party. So George Carlin had it right again when he said, "It's a big club and we're not in it." In fact, a Princeton study that came out last year found that the U.S. is not a democracy. It's an oligarchy. Politicians are more likely to respond to the will of big money than to the will of the people. Woodrow Wilson said in his justification of World War I that we were making the world safe for democracy, and we've been using that argument ever since for our aggressive forays into other countries. But the argument hardly holds water if we can't maintain a democracy at home. In fact, other countries seem to do a better job than we do of responding to the will of the people. For example, in Greece, the Syriza Party recently won the presidency. The Syriza Party is a populist left-wing party that came out of nowhere a couple of years ago and took the electorate by storm. And in Spain, it looks like the Podemos Party will do the same thing. It, too, is a left-wing populist party, and it's well ahead in the polls. But in the U.S., we haven't had a third-party president since Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln was actually a Republican, but there were four major parties running, and the Republicans at that time were new, so in that sense, they were a third party. Ever since 1900, we've had the party of J.P. Morgan and the party of John D. Rockefeller pretty much competing with each other. Nomi Prince says there are six big banks and six big banking families that have pretty much controlled the presidency and controlled Congress for the last 100 years. The two largest third parties in the U.S. are the Libertarians and the Greens. Ralph Nader got the farthest among the Greens running for president. He got 3% of the vote in 2000 and 1% of the vote in 2004, which is pretty good considering 3% of the vote was 3 million people. But all he really got out of the deal was to be branded the spoiler who stole votes away from Al Gore, giving the election to George W. Bush. Of course, the Greens and Ralph Nader dispute that that was what really happened. But that is another reason that we're pretty much limited to a two-party system. People are afraid to vote for anyone but the two big parties for fear that they will be throwing away their vote and helping to install the greater of two evils as opposed to the lesser of two evils. In California, we have 39 million people, so it's almost as hard to get elected if you're not one of the two big, heavily funded parties. I actually ran for state treasurer last year and got 270,000 votes, which was 6.6% of the vote. Not bad. It was the best that any third-party candidates for any of the statewide offices, but obviously not nearly enough to win. Another limitation in California is that we now have a top two primary, or also called a jungle primary, where all the candidates for all the parties run together in the primary, and only the top two go on to the election in November. So these will necessarily be the Democrat and the Republican, or maybe in California, two Democrats, because again, they're the only ones with the money to get on national TV and on statewide media. Just to put an ad in the LA Times now, as a full-page ad is $100,000. At the city level, on the other hand, there is some chance of getting elected as a third party. Not a big chance, but it has been done. The biggest city to have a Green Party mayor is Richmond, California, which has 100,000 people. And Gail McLaughlin was elected mayor there in 2006 and served until 2014 when she was termed out as a Green. And then she ran for city council and won again, even though Chevron put up $3 million to try to defeat her and her colleagues. Chevron has been considered to own Richmond, pretty much, but during her term as mayor, Gail McLaughlin managed to get a sizable tax settlement out of Chevron, and she has been pushing for this eminent domain plan where underwater mortgages will be taken back by the city and refinanced on behalf of the homeowners, and that, of course, is opposed by the big banks. So here is this Green mayor who has stood up to Chevron and stood up to the big bank quite successfully. So that shows what could be done if we had elected officials who were not beholden to big money, who could actually vote their consciences and could vote on behalf of the people. So how can we get there from here? How can we get elected officials who are not beholden to big money? Obviously, campaign financing should be redone, but how do we do that when big money controls the legislatures? Today's noteworthy guest has some innovative solutions coming up. I'm really pleased to be talking to Gar Alperovitz, who has a very long list of credentials, but I'm going to read them because they're so impressive. Gar has had a distinguished career as a historian, political economist, activist, writer, and government official. For 15 years, he served as the Lionel R. Bauman Professor of Political Economy at the University of Maryland and is a former fellow of King's College, Cambridge University, Harvard's Institute of Politics, the Institute for Policy Studies, and a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution. He is the author of a number of critically acclaimed books, including America Beyond Capitalism and What Then Must We Do? His articles have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and many other popular publications. He has been a guest on numerous network TV and cable news programs, including Meet the Press and Larry King Live, and his work has been featured in TV documentaries. He has served as a legislative director in both houses of Congress and as a special assistant in the State Department, and has testified before numerous congressional committees. He is a founding principal of the Democracy Collaborative and a co-founder of the Next System Project, which I'll be asking him all about. He lectures widely around the country, and we are honored to have him as a keynote speaker at our Public Banking Institute conference in 2013. It's really great to be talking to you, Gar.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Ellen.
Thanks. So, You're really focused on solutions, and that's also my focus, so, you know, that's what I really want to get into. Your books, America Beyond Capitalism and What Then Must We Do, address the rather hopeless state of democracy at the national level in our capitalist system today. Big money runs the show and has the national government pretty much locked up. And last week, Fast Track was actually passed for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, so it's liable to get worse. So how can we get out of this trap? You suggest that we need to go beyond both capitalism and state socialism, and that more regional, local solutions are the way to go. Could you expand on that?
Well, it is extremely difficult times, and most people are focused on the pain, the deadlock in Washington, the declining trends, worsening income inequality, wealth inequality, global climate change, global warming, loss of liberties. All the trends are going south. And, and, you know, if you read the disgust with Congress, I just saw a set of polls today that show just the decline in belief in Washington and in Congress and in the government in general for the last 30 years is more and more obvious. So that's you know, the polls used to say 35 years ago, the Gallup poll would ask people, what do you think about Washington or your congressman? They say, well, my congressman goes to Washington, and he's a good guy. He represents us and does the best by us. But they ask the same kind of question today, and what they basically come out saying is, my congressman goes to Washington, and the lobbyists and the big money get to him, and he does what they say. So we are in a state of not only economic and social and environmental pain, but it's a period where people are waking up to something's wrong. And I think that is the one, you know, positive in all this. At the same time, at the local level, there's a huge amount of experimentation and development of new ideas and new projects that the national press just doesn't cover. And the local press doesn't either, partly because it's pretty conservative press, but even more because, you know, the local press is going bankrupt because of the internet, and they don't have reporters to cover what's going on locally, even if they wanted to, which they largely don't. So people simply don't know how much is happening in response. And you know, I think, and many people we've been working with on the Next System Project have been looking at how you build up over time, starting at the grassroots level, both projects and ideas that begin to build momentum step by step and begin to suggest things not only locally, but things that can be expanded upon nationally over time. You know, the way to think about it is the big, big things that happened at the national level in the New Deal, labor law, Social Security, various forms of welfare programs, et cetera, all of that was experimented first at the state and local level, and then refinements were developed there, and when the time was right, politics built up to make them national. And I think that's what's happening potentially now. One of the things that's going on is, as you know, there's great interest in public banking at the local level as well as at the state level. Several cities are exploring setting up public banks. And that kind of development is a major step towards state banks like the one in North Dakota, and ultimately what it takes to figure out the details of, and the politics of how to change the national banking system. Same is going on with worker-owned companies. There are many, several hundred worker-owned co-ops in the United States, and another several thousand worker-owned companies that aren't quite structured by as a co-op, but they are worker-owned. And that development is building up steadily over time, and you can expect that over time to begin to take on national implications as well. So that's the kind of picture. I stand back kind of as a historian, and I don't get lost in today's difficulties. What you see is the difficulties are generating responses, positive responses as well as negative. And if you go back and think about how historical change occurs, it's almost always step by step under the radar for a long time before it explodes into popular action, like the civil rights movement or the feminist movement or the early environmental movement. Indeed, if you look at the conservative movement in the 1940s, it was nowhere. It was totally under the radar. And by hard work, even though I disagree with them, conservatives built up from way, way marginal forces in the 1940s to the power they have today. And I think, their days are numbered, too, as the next movement and the next system project and the new economy movement begin to develop. At least that's a reasonable possibility that people are working on.
Well, I agree, and that's definitely the hope, is the hope at the local level, and that maybe we can come in under the radar and get some experiments set up. I mean, we'd love to get a public bank set up somewhere. It seems to me that once we had a model, that the others would follow like lemmings. Elected officials are generally risk-averse, and they don't want to be the first ones to jump in unless they have a huge constituency behind them. I mean, we're learning as we go all the different ways of approaching legislators and what you need and how to form our arguments and what arguments we're going to get in response. And so bit by bit, I think we'll hopefully get there, although it might happen in another country before it happens here. But I agree, I feel that's totally true, that it has to be on the local level. But I wonder about this Trans-Pacific Partnership. I mean, they're going to be able to shut down virtually everything, it seems like, by assuming it gets passed, by saying it interferes with their corporate profits. And of course, that's what all these local movements are about, to get back our money, get back our system in one way or another, and do it for ourselves. So what do you think? How do we overcome this? Or do you think it's going to pass in the first place?
Well, it's unclear whether it will pass or there'll be modifications. There's been a strong reaction to it. But even if it passes, NAFTA passed as well. NAFTA is now part and parcel of the structure of law in many areas, and it has many of the same provisions. However, and this is really the interesting thing, in practice it's not as easy to enforce as one might think, and particularly when there's local public reactions. Even though there's a legal case, people have found ways around it, and also some of the companies haven't wanted to pursue the legal action that they technically might have. So, the law is one thing, but if people begin to protest and resist, laws get changed, and even treaties don't last forever. So, in the short run, there's going to be major problems, but if we build up the politics around this, and I think that's what all the social and economic pain is generating, reactions and resistance, then we challenge things like NAFTA and the Trans-Pacific Partnership as well, step by step.
Yeah, it actually might be a good thing in the sense that it's so outrageous and they've kept it so secret, and the bits that we have learned are so clearly anti-public interest and pro-big corporate money that it does seem like people might just get so outraged that they overthrow the whole federal, the federal deadlock government and break in with something new. And I don't think there's much hope of getting a third party in today. I just wrote an article on that, and I had to give a presentation in San Diego State University. It was a debate on the crisis in democracy, and it was basically about how third parties don't have much chance these days. But let's say we had another Occupy-style movement, but that actually had some solutions. I mean, Occupy
purposely avoided going for the solutions because they knew they would get shot down as soon as they picked some. I mean, there'd be some people for and some people against, and they wouldn't have the same unity. But we could arguably maybe at some point have a big, I mean, that's something I'd envision and hope for, but how can we get everyone together on the same page? I guess that's what your next system project is all about. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes, two things. One, I mean, I think at where we are now is at one level, and people growing awareness that something's really wrong. And just gut feeling, but also poll data, and also, I mean, the poll data is very, very strong on that the problem is not simply politics in the normal sense. I think there's three polls that I've seen, for instance, of people under 30, you know, kind of amazing polls, because they say that people under 30, by and large, are slightly more favorable to the word socialism than capitalism, which is kind of an amazing reality, but it tells you that people realize that something's really wrong. At this stage of our development, and I keep thinking of stages, one of the things is disillusionment, and you need disillusionment before you get a new vision and a new way to think about things. You've got to get rid of the old ideas, and that's happening fast. And number two is developing local projects that begin to show concrete ways forward. And public banking is one, but work around co-ops and very complex ones is another. In Boulder, they've taken over this, they're municipalizing the utility in order to deal with those climate change problems. So there are many, many examples. And the next system project is really an attempt signed by, again, it tells you that something's really interesting because 5,000 people have signed this statement already, and there are lots of people on progressives and on the left who you would expect. But we have, you know, the president of the American Political Science, two presidents of the American Political Science Association, president of the American Sociological Association, the current president of the Academy of Management, which is a business, large 10,000-person association of business consultants and business professors, signed a statement that, and the statement says, we face a systemic crisis, but we need to acknowledge this, and that we need to begin talking about changing the system in new ways that go beyond the old models of corporate capitalism and state socialism. There's got to be a better way than the dying models. And we're finding lots of people understand that. It isn't, you know, it's not so outrageous. Robert Reich, the Secretary of Labor under Clinton, signed the statement. So did Jeff Sachs, a very prominent political scientist. But lots and lots of folks who aren't, you know, are ordinary folks signing at every level, movie stars like Danny Glover, saying, yes, we've got to talk about this. We can't just keep it under the rug. There's something really profoundly wrong. And that's the first step in then saying, well, what is to be done? What can we do? And beginning to explore the many, many ideas that the many projects we were talking about. But there are a number of people who have been writing about what a way forward that avoids the pitfalls of corporate capitalism and the pitfalls of state socialism. There's a big discussion of that. Many writers, David Corton is one, Richard Wolff is another, Professor Unger at Harvard is another. There's many, many people who have begun to write different ways of thinking about this from an ecological point of view. My co-chair in the Next System Project, Gus Speth, is another. And Gus is an interesting one. Gus Speth is, you know, he's written about how we need to really change the system in very practical ways. But Gus was chief environmental advisor to President Carter, and an important environmental advisor to President Clinton. He was head of UNDP, the world's UN's huge development global organization. He was head of that, and dean of the Yale School of Environment. And Gus has come to the same conclusion that the environmental trends, not only the climate change, but many of them are just getting worse unless we face the fact that we have a system problem and time to talk about it and launch a discussion about what's happening and what should be done. And that's the purpose of the Next System project. And to make it as practical as possible, not a bunch of rhetoric. We're interested in solutions, not rhetoric. And at every level, local, state, regional, national, global, what can be done if we go beyond the boundaries of what can be talked about between the Republicans and Democrats these days. I think many people understand that, just haven't been talking about it.
Mm-hmm. So what would you envision as the next step after a petition? I mean, where are we going to talk about it, and what's, you know what I mean? Are you thinking of debates?
Well, we're thinking about lots of things. So, for instance, one of the things immediately, we've had so many, we've had such a big response to this that we didn't quite expect it as rapidly. One thing that's obvious is, because people have been asking, what can be done locally? And what are one of the things that makes sense, we think, is study action groups. Now, what does that mean? It means calling a half a dozen friends and begin talking about, read this statement on the next system project, and that it's time to talk about systemic issues. Sort of, on the one hand, it looks like a book club. Read something about it. But on the other hand, ask a question, what can we do locally that would move the ball? We're going to hope to give a lot of examples of what people are doing in many parts of the country, including some of the things we just talked about a few minutes ago, and try to start local study action groups. That's a very fast, immediate thing besides just assigning the statement. That's number one. There's a whole lot of research that needs to be done, and policy research. So, for instance, you've done a lot of work on public banking. Well, what would be the exact structure, change it into even legislative form, that would set up the, perfectly designed, or at least the best design we could get of a local, state, national public banking system, beyond just saying we need it, beyond the outlines we've had, but let's put some legislation together so we have something very concrete to talk about. What do you do about big, big corporations in any system? Some things have to be big. Well, how do you control them? We need research and development on that. One of the things we looked at is the Tennessee Valley Authority, which is there since it's a big, actually it's a socialist entity in 14 states, the largest utility, and it's involved with managing the Tennessee River system. There it is, this big socialist entity, and Obama tried to get rid of it. He tried to sell it off. And all the Republicans in the area, all the conservatives said, no, we want to keep it because it's good. So we're beginning to say, what would you do on the regional level that builds on some of the examples we know about? The idea is both, what can you do locally? How do we generate very, very specific programmatic development that moves in the right direction? And we debate all that. How do we debate alternative ideas about what would be a good system beyond capitalism, beyond socialism? We've had two conferences so far. And this gives you an idea of the quality of the discussion. The first one was at Harvard, and the second one was at MIT, beginning to try to develop how to go forward. And we want to really keep it at that level of discussion, very, very serious, thoughtful people involved. Well, we've identified at least 10 to 15 people who've written books on what they think is the best way to think about the next system. Virtually all of them are anti-corporate capitalism, and virtually all of them are anti-state socialism. Some of them are very heavily environmental. So, for instance, Professor Juliet Shore has written a powerful book on how you start at the local level, really starting with environmental questions and build up to a different model. Others are starting at worker ownership. Richard Wolff starts at that level and tries to build a model that really emphasizes that the people doing the work should own the businesses rather than either the government or the big corporations. And, I've written a book about my view of how plural forms of ownership, what I call pluralist commonwealth, is the way to begin to think about it. And Gus Speth, my co-chair in the project, has also written a book on how he sees the model. And the point is not to buy any one model, but to have a really thoughtful debate about what really makes sense. And truthfully, there are many, many people beginning to think about this that most people don't know about. And it's important to have a good public discussion also of these larger themes.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by plural commonwealth?
I use the term pluralist commonwealth to describe it, because the notion is there are many different ways. We shouldn't have just one size fits all thinking about this. So, for instance, worker co-ops is one form of commonwealth building. And there are, you know, lots of these around, and the 500 or so and several thousand worker-owned companies. That's one form. But in a city, municipal ownership is city ownership. It's not worker ownership. So that's a different form. In many neighborhoods, a land trust, that is nonprofit corporation that tries to hold down housing costs by owning and controlling land on behalf of the neighborhood, that's a neighborhood ownership, a different form of plural, neither worker nor city, but in this case, neighborhood. And another one where you've written a lot about is state banks. That's state ownership, common ownership, but in this case, at the level of the state. I mentioned another one earlier, which was the region. Tennessee Valley Authority is a regional form of common ownership. So that's another form of plural ownership. And nationally as well, there are likely to be some things that are too big for most states or regions, and that would be national ownership in some areas, probably the big piece of the big banks ultimately. So you can begin to ask practical questions. What makes sense at what scale? And how do we make that democratically owned and controlled rather than owned by big corporations or big government? So that's the idea of plural forms of ownership and plural, or what I call the plural commonwealth.
Would you want to go into some examples of cooperatives that have worked? You know, what's going on, in other words, in these experimental models?
Yeah, there's some really interesting ones. You know, in part, the drawing on the big Mondragon cooperatives in the Basque region of Spain, which is a 60,000-person, very high-tech, a very interesting set of successful cooperatives. You know, wages are, in most of it, the top to bottom is 6-to-1, rather than the United States, most corporations, it's 350-to-1. The ratio. And in the Mondragon big ones, it's 8 or 9 to 1. That's the maximum ratio they have. And they're very interesting, successful models. There's several people working on trying to replicate certain parts of this in the United States. In Cleveland, it's an area that our own group, the Democracy Collaborative, has worked on. There's a complex model partly based on Mondragon. So, for instance, in a neighborhood of 40,000, there's a nonprofit corporation as the main element, and sort of hanging off of it, if you like, are worker-owned or multi-stakeholder companies that are partly owned by the workers and partly owned by the nonprofit corporation. They can't be sold off. They have to stay in the community and help the community, the neighborhood of about 40,000. So one of them is a you know, very large industrial-scale greenhouse. They're not little co-ops. This one can produce 3 million heads of lettuce a year. It's one of the companies. Another one is an industrial-scale laundry of the kind that serves hospitals and universities and nursing homes. And it's one of the greenest in the Midwest, used about a third of the water and a third of the heat. And that's another one of the worker-owned companies connected and jointly with the neighborhood corporation. And the third one is a worker-owned solar installation company. And it's just installed one of the largest urban solar fields in the United States. And they're trying to build one or two more a year in this growing complex. It's really interesting because they're significant scale. They're community building rather than just trying to make a few workers, not rich, but, you know, benefit them, but try to benefit the community as a whole as well. Structures built into the structure. And then related to that, and this is true in many cities that are experimenting with this, there are big hospitals and universities right in this neighborhood. Case Western Reserve University, Cleveland Clinic, one of the biggest and most famous ones in the world, and University Hospital are there. And they buy just about $3 billion in goods and services, none of it until very recently from the neighborhood. So partly it's to focus some of the purchasing power in ways that build up these complex new democratically owned companies and in a way that benefits the neighborhood, not just the individuals involved, but also uses the purchasing power of these so-called anchor institutions. They're anchored. They can't get up and go. And so that's the term people use these days, anchor institutions, for usually hospitals and universities. And there's a lot of public money in those as well, Medicare, Medicaid, education money. So why shouldn't we use that public money in a way that produces public benefits? So that's a complex that's, you know, many people have been very excited about already on the ground in Cleveland, and a number of cities have been experimenting with variations on that. And it gives you an idea of what I was saying earlier, that you can start at the local level and begin developing very sophisticated things that might be models to build on over time as politics shifts. In the way that the prehistory of the New Deal built models and then became the basis of the next system.
Mm-hmm. I think people are getting more aware, too, that we need more community, not even talking about just economically, but people are so isolated from each other. I mean, you see communities developing where they have more social things going on together. I don't know what they're called, but anyway. I mean, I live in a senior village where, right, we used to have a nice house with a pool and jacuzzi, but it was a lot of upkeep, and so we didn't really keep the things warm, and they weren't warm when you wanted them. But if you live in a community where they have a community pool and community jacuzzi, it's always hot. You can always go in. I mean, there are many advantages to living communally. I get to walk all around here, and I feel like I own the whole place, like it's a big park, and I own the whole place, whereas actually I don't own anything. But when we had our own, you know, a big yard, it was just our big backyard, and that was it, and it was closed off from the neighbors. So I think people are sort of craving community anyway, and there are different experiments going on that are just in terms of getting together. America is probably, or the U.S. is one of the more, a place where people are more isolated than they are in maybe poorer countries where they have more extended family situations.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think people sense that. And then it becomes, how do we build practical things that make sense, and trial and error in one community, trial and error in another community, and come up with models that can be general. And I think mm-hmm. that's where we are in lots of areas. People are experimenting. If you looked around the country, you could find a really exciting elder care situation, really exciting worker-owned companies, really interesting educational experiments, really interesting healthcare experiments. Almost any area you look at it in the United States today, there are practical things on the ground that suggest what could be done for the country as a whole if it got serious. It's no longer just utopian theory. We know lots of things around the country, and putting them together in a vision and thinking about how they might organize nationally, that's kind of how you build systems. There's more to it. You have to think about the economics and the politics and the Constitution, but it starts at putting together the best experiments and then working from the bottom up to what would it take to make this what the country looks like. I think the best way to think about it is practical and then build from there.
Mm-hmm. My daughter's thing is biomimicry, where you copy natural systems, and it seems that she says that we're the humans that are, well, the capitalist system where you're competing with each other is actually a rather juvenile level of development of an organism, and that as you get more mature, you become a superorganism where all the cells work together. So you have like bees and fungi, I guess, are superorganisms that all work together. Or there are certain trees where it's like all one root, although many trees sticking up. So I think that's the level we're at, and that the internet will be, in effect, our sort of super brain, where we all actually can communicate with each other and see what's going on. When you find out all these other models that are going on elsewhere that are working better than what you're living in, then you're motivated to merge and try out those things and develop a better system. So I think it is all positive, and even the fact that it looks so negative in many ways, I mean, we're captured by big money. It's people, like you say, are becoming more and more aware of that, and we're just not going to tolerate it too much longer. Hopefully we don't have to do a violent revolution. We can just do an economic revolution and a political revolution. I mean, that is the difficult thing, how we get from here to there. But like you, I think it's hopeful in the end.
The term I've been using is, you know, in sort of traditional reform, I used to work in politics, as you mentioned, at the outset with liberal Democrats. And there you really don't challenge the basic system. You try to reform around it. You let the corporations have control, and you try to pass a tax bill to make it a little better. That's reform. And then violent revolution is, you know, big overthrow of the government and then whatever comes next. And that has often disastrous results. But what the term I use is evolutionary reconstruction, that we're evolving and at the same time reconstructing institutions. And that's the way that you are changing institutions, but in an evolutionary build-up way, and politics connected to that is different from either simple reform or simple revolution. And I think that's, you know, that's the hopeful side. You never know in politics. We may have a long period of decay. It may be not possible. On the other hand, you know, think about the civil rights movement came out of nowhere, the women's movement came out of nowhere, the environmental movement came out of nowhere, the anti-war movements again and again have come out of nowhere. Even the modern conservatives, I always remind people, in the 1940s were totally lost, and they built up out of nowhere to real power. So I look at this as a historian and think about the next decades rather than the next week. Things may not be so difficult as some people think.
And we may, well, if you look at 1933, I mean, that was totally radical. Many people think we're heading for another economic collapse like 2008. And this time, we see that rescuing the banks, it didn't work. They were effectively nationalized for a while, and then we privatized them again. Maybe next time we'll try something different and something better. And so all these little local experiments are models where hopefully our legislators will look around and say, well, what about that model? Let's try that. That seemed to work.
Yeah, exactly. And also building up the politics around that, more and more people, you know, supporting these models. And, you know, if it's not the next crisis, maybe the one after that. That is to say, we know that there are reasons why these things fail, and they'll probably continue to fail. It's building more and more models, thinking in a sophisticated way about how historic history changes. I'm not a pessimist. I'm not a wild-eyed optimist, but I think we've got a reasonable shot of building steadily over time. And it's really, you know, the good thing about it is this. No matter what happens, almost everything we're talking about here is good to do no matter what. So, you know, a state bank is better than not having a state bank. And hopefully these are laying groundwork for overall system change. But they're positive to do no matter what.
Right. Well, it's been really great hearing your thoughts on all that. Do you have websites that you'd like to share?
Yeah, thenextsystem.com, one word, thenextsystem.com, is one place. Another place is the Democracy Collaborative, one word, democracycollaborative.com. Still another one is community-wealth.org or .com. Put the dash in, because if you don't, you might get to a different website. And this one brings you all kinds of examples of what's going on around the country. It's kind of a website of websites, community-wealth. So those are the three main ones.
Well, that's great. Thank you. It's been great talking to you.
Thanks for having me, Ellen. Great talking with you. Look forward to seeing you again soon.
Okay, and good luck with your project.
I've been speaking with Dr. Gar Alperovitz, co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative and the Next System Project, and author of What Then Must We Do? An America Beyond Capitalism.
You've heard the phrase funny money, right? Well, we're going to head in that direction a little ways with a funny, a bit more cute than funny, I suppose, musical variation on a Wizard of Oz song with a short performance of If I Only Had a Bank, a parody that was written for California residents a couple of years ago when the state was considering creating its own public bank, a measure, by the way, that's getting some new life these days.
California's a failure because we haven't got a bank.
Well, what would you do with a bank if you had one?
Do? If California had a bank?
Who could rightly use what's ours to cultivate the flowers and clean our septic tank? We could trade unemployment for service and enjoyment if we only had a bank. When we're stuck and need some credit and Wall Street says forget it, we won't be in the tank. We could pass on lesser offers, borrow cash from our own coffers, if we only had a bank. Oh, why? Tell me why. The economy hit the floor. We're sinking lower than we sunk before. And all the jobs, they've gone offshore. We can stimulate production, construction, and instruction by standing for this plank. Just 11 million voters will be like North Dakota. We'll finally have a bank. If we get up off our assets and get the folks to pass it, we'll finally have a bank.
Thanks to Steve Behrman of WakeUpLaughing.com for that first contribution to our new show feature, Funny Money. Well, we just heard from the venerable Gar Alperovitz about what we have to do to realize next steps in making dramatic economic reform. Part of that picture includes how we plan to deal with our existing national debt. In a new book called America is Not Broke, Four Multi-Trillion Dollar Paths to a Thriving America, our colleague Scott Baker addresses head-on the national debt boogeyman that's kicked about constantly on the political stage. Scott Baker is an associate editor of Op-Ed News, and he's a resident expert on monetary issues and financial reform trends and issues. And we talked briefly about his four approaches to resolving and eliminating the national debt.
Your new book is called America is Not Broke. And of course, you're aware that that's going against the common knowledge that everybody thinks that we have no money. Tell us about what your book is describing.
People think the country is broke, and we hear it endlessly from the mainstream media and from all the so-called experts that we have this big debt. But I set out to prove that there are these really multi-trillion dollar solutions to our so-called debt crisis or our lack of resources, let's say. So basically, what I wanted to do was do a book that had more than one solution. But what I wanted to do was something that somebody couldn't say, well, I don't believe in public banking, so therefore there's no answer to our economic woes. So then I would say, okay, well, you don't believe in that one. What about land value taxation or Georgism? Or what about green backing sovereign money? You know, so pretty soon you run out of arguments and you can't deny them all. So if I do four of them, I figure I'll get them on at least one or two.
When you talk about Georgism, that's a term that I think most people don't know. Would you tell us a little bit about what that would look like?
All right. Well, that basically means taxing the land and the locational value, site value, instead of buildings or improvements. And this, the reason it's called Georgism, it goes back to Henry George, who was a 19th century journalist economist. And he wrote this great book called Progress and Poverty, which is still a bestseller. And at that time was actually second only to the Bible. And what he proved pretty much is that if you tax the land, that is particularly location, you would get enough revenue out of that, first of all, that you wouldn't have to tax productive activities. So you wouldn't have to tax wages or sales or true capital like buildings themselves. You could just tax the location. And furthermore, it's fair and it's just because, you know, if you think about it, the locational value really comes out of our collective demand for the site, S-I-T-E. And so, you know, if you're a Robinson Crusoe alone on an island, there's no demand, so then there's no economy. But if you're in a city, there's a lot of demand, and you're paying per square foot. And so, therefore, you know, it gets to be very expensive to live in certain parts of the city. And we say, as Georgists, well, you know, that money really belongs to the community because it's their demand that created it. So the rent for that location really should go back to the community. And what's happening now all too often is that it's privatized. Either there's a tax break, so, you know, it's supposedly to incentivize developers to build buildings. So either way, you know, the municipalities are not getting the benefit of trillions of dollars. So we know in New York City alone, there's $500 trillion just in land values in New York City, just according to them.
Are there places where Georgism is being applied now?
It was actually applied in New York City in the 1920s and early 30s. And that's one reason we have such a building boom that we still have pre-war buildings to this day. So, you know, it was working. What happens is it encourages building because you can't hold sites idle because you'll be taxed on them. It actually goes back to biblical times. You can read the Old Testament or read John Kelly's book called The Other Law of Moses, which actually is about the land value tax in ancient Israel. And so it goes back to that. It goes back to our own country and the original Articles of Confederation, which were based on a property tax. So they were aware that the locational value even then was special.
You've mentioned public banking and Georgism. Then you talk about sovereign money as another one of the multi-trillion-dollar reforms available. What would that look like to get us out of being, quote-unquote, broke?
Right. Well, now, sovereign money, you know, it goes back to the fact that we basically have to rent our money from a central bank. So we don't produce most of our money in this country. When I say we, I mean the government. We actually have a central bank that does it, so we buy treasuries and we pay a little bit of interest. Sometimes it's more, sometimes it's less. Right now it's less, but it can go up again. But the problem is that the Fed itself only owes 18% of the treasuries. So basically most of those treasuries get sold abroad or to other entities. Two biggest holders abroad are China and Japan. So what happens in China particularly is that they buy a lot of our treasuries, which makes their yuan, their currency, weaker and makes ours stronger because ours is being bought. So that means that their exports are more competitive than ours because they're priced in a cheaper currency. So we lose jobs because they're buying our treasuries to weaken their currency and strengthen ours. So what we say as greenbackers is that we can produce money sovereignly. By the way, President Lincoln did during the Civil War with something called the United States Notes, which he used to pay the Northern troops instead of taking a bank loan for 24% to 36% interest, yeah, which is what they wanted.
And your fourth mechanism for reform of our debt is ending government financial asset hoarding.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
So what we have is a lot of these huge funds, and when I say a lot, I mean about 200,000 across the country that are basically government assets, liquid assets. I'm not talking about fixed capital. I mean things that they've invested, particularly pension funds, which are very large. To give you an example, we have $160 billion in the New York City pension fund and roughly that state fund as well. So that money is only paid out maybe 2% to 4% of that gets paid out to the pensioners a year, and for that privilege, we're asked to keep 96% or more in a fund, which supposedly will earn enough return on investment to pay the pensioners. But there's two problems with that. Number one, they don't even earn that much money, and we pay a lot in fees. We pay millions of dollars in fees. New York City can pay $100 million just to Wall Street managers to manage that kind of money, and they often underperform the S&P. And the second problem is that basically we're allocating almost in the entire fund to this sort of Wall Street investment instead of into a place where it might do some good, such as a public bank.
Right.
So one of the proposals is that we could take 10% of these, you know, these assets and put them into a public bank. And that even if the return is slightly less, the point is you're investing in the community and you're creating jobs and you're creating credit, which the state can't do otherwise. And the bank itself, since it's owned by the state or owned by a big city, returns the proceeds as a dividend to whatever entity owns it. So you're not paying for a bond issuance. You might pay 6-7 cents.
Well, Scott, congratulations on your new book. It's America Is Not Broke, 4 Multi-Trillion-Dollar Paths to a Thriving America. Where can people find the book?
All right. Well, right now it's on the publisher's site, which is called Tayen Lane. That's T-A-Y-E-N Lane, like a lane of a road. There is a site on Amazon, so you can look for it.
Well, thank you once again for taking the time and telling us about America Is Not Broke. Thanks, Scott.
Our cities are going broke. And that means people are getting broken too. I'm Matt Stannard with your public banking report. We all know that our nation's cities are in the midst of budgetary crises. What many of us don't know, though, is that this is not a result of spending money on services. In fact, social spending typically produces rather than costs revenue for cities because social spending increases health and productivity and the attractiveness of a city. No, the culprit here is big banks, Wall Street banks. that charge interest and fees that essentially make us pay for keeping and handling our money. When big private banks handle deposits or pension funds, and when they lend to cities, they charge fees. Wall Street recently cost New York City $2.5 billion to handle the city's pensions, wiping out the gains from the pensions. They made Los Angeles pay $204 million in fees in 2012 and 2013, and they made Oakland pay 20% of its city budget, $204 million in fees in 2013. And if they're doing this to bigger cities, you can imagine the impact it's having on smaller ones. In response to these economic challenges, ruling classes in large and small urban areas are behaving in a particularly brutal manner. In the novel 1984, George Orwell had one of his characters say, "If you want a vision of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face." Unfortunately, that vision is being enacted in cities all over the country. In Detroit, county officials are threatening to evict tens of thousands of people, possibly as many as 100,000 people, all at the same time. This comes on top of Detroit's water shutoffs, condemned by the United Nations last year, more impending shutoffs to come this year. Baltimore is about to shut off the water too, and they've had a rash of police violence incidents lately. In Ferguson, Missouri, and other small cities across St. Louis County and other parts of the country as well, cops act as wealth takers, purposely imposing fines on poor people to run as much as a third of their city budgets. The end result is more poverty, more people in jail, consequent unemployment, riots, police shootings, and miserable neighborhoods. Don't believe me? Even financial experts agree. According to Bloomberg News, Howard Cure, who's head of municipal research at New York-based Evercore Wealth Management, said Ferguson's reliance on revenue from police citations may have contributed to public anger after Officer Darren Wilson shot and killed 18-year-old Michael Brown last year. It leads to animosity and distrust that might have even spawned some of the unrest we're seeing, Cure said. Our cities are a mess because Wall Street is taking their money. And city officials think they only have two choices, raise taxes or brutalize poor people through evictions, shutoffs, and fines. Meanwhile, many cities can't even offer basic services. Charity and relief programs help. They're run and staffed by great people, many of whom are good friends of mine. But they don't change the game, and sometimes they unwittingly reinforce the very hierarchies that produce the misery such organizations then struggle to address. We need to change the game itself, by changing the way communities produce and distribute value. Economic justice is a prerequisite to social justice, and good fiscal policy is necessary for funding peaceful local communities. Public banks would be a great start in that process, because public banks would handle public finances rather than making cities pay Wall Street billions of dollars to do it, because public banks would lend to small businesses and to citywide infrastructure and services, and because public banks would pay dividends back into city treasuries. I'm not saying we can totally eliminate poverty and police brutality that way, but it would be a damn good start. After all, it's our money. I'm Matt Stannard.
That's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Brought to you with support from Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services, dedicated to the cause of economic justice and fairness and to the creation of new American public banks. Visit them at paymentmgmt.com to request a complimentary analysis of your current card processing expenses. Be sure to follow Ellen Brown's commentary by going to ellenbrown.com. And you can hear previous editions of this program through podcast by going to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown at prn.fm. Our thanks to Payment Management, our guests, prn.fm, and to you for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.